Okay, this is side two.
Sounds like the comedies of errors, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's about it.
Side two, tape number one, Louise M. Thaden. See how nice I say that? 1101 North Main Street, High Point, North Carolina. By the way, I don't think I said on the other side of the date. This is January the 10th, Monday, 1977, and it's now just 15 minutes after 3. We must start at the other side about 2:15. Okay. If there's any question you want to ask whatsoever, I just wanted to impress you that we've gone into this in great detail, and it's taken about 7 years to put it all together. And
I can imagine, and I'm so happy that finally you got the Navy and the Coast Guard records.
They released all that. In fact, they've been most cooperative. They really have been. All the people who were involved are now all retired and gone from there. All the people who were going to be the first person nabbed on these things are all now retired. Their careers are not in jeopardy. Mm. Actually, that's pointless. I'm not out to nail anybody for anything.
No.
However.
Well, I don't think anybody ever has been. It's just a matter of they have wanted to find out what really happened.
Well, it's like Commander Thompson said here in the last page of his report. Now, this is as we see it here on the Itasca. Possibly, if Amelia were here, her story would be somewhat different. Boy, would it ever. And I'm going to present Amelia's side of the story of what happened. And it is a comedy of errors, and a real tearful comedy, because Fred Noonan must have had a sinking feeling in the pit of his stomach of, you know, abject failure. And really, it wasn't his fault. It really wasn't. He really got trapped. And same with Amelia. Amelia never, you know, she never knew what she couldn't do anything but follow what Noonan said to do. As you know, they got lost going into Africa. I don't know if you remember.
No,
they were going to Dakar, and they ended up in St. Louis.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was, she said, admitted that was her fault.
Yes. Well, in a way, but in another way, it was. But also, it was the fault of their radio. Their radio had been out ever since they'd left the Caribbean. They didn't tell anybody about it. In fact, in her book, she wrote, or at least she sent back messages indicating that she would have contacted that French airplane going by, which they saw going across the Atlantic, except that he was on a different frequency. Well, the truth of the matter was her radio was out and had been out for days, and it was out all the way.
How did you find that out?
Well, two ways. One,
Fred wrote a letter to his wife.
Mrs. Ireland. And in the letter, he was kind of explaining why they didn't land at a car. And he said one of the reasons, they couldn't get a bearing because on the DF station because their radio had been inoperative since they'd left San Juan. And when she got to Darwin, Australia, I was rummaging through the old Sydney, Australia's attaché, whoever was in Sydney, not the ambassador, the next consulate, their old files, and I found a letter that had been written from the Consul General in Sydney to the Secretary of State mentioning a sergeant in the Royal Australian Air Force who had upbraided Amelia at Darwin, Australia, for not contacting his official radio station. You know, they were very snooty in Australia, and she had a shot record that wasn't stamped by the health department, and they wouldn't even accept the personal doctor's signature and stamp. And it caused her a day's delay over that. Dr. Brothers was the one who was responsible for all that. And so I went out to find Sergeant Stan Rose, and I found him.
In Australia.
I went down and I found him living near Sydney. And I had some help. Do you know Nancy Bird, by any chance? Well, Nancy Bird Walton helped us immeasurably throughout all.
She would.
And Lady Casey, I don't know.
I don't know.
Well, she made the National Archives and the National Library and the Department of Civil Aviation and everything government at our feet and disposal. When we went into the National Library, we didn't bother with the clerk. We had the head of the department help us, and they were very, very helpful. But anyway, we found Sergeant Stan Rose, and he said that he cornered Amelia about this, why she hadn't contacted him. He sent her a message at Timor telling her how and everything, and she was evasive, and she's being a little coy about it. And he persisted, and finally she said, well, the thing doesn't work. And he said, well, maybe I can set it right. She said, I wish you would. And so I set about at it. He said, I got checking around. I found a blown fuse in her dynamotor for her DF receiver. And I replaced the fuse, showed her where it was, and gave her a couple of spares, and told her if it goes out again, take a check, you know. And I tested it. It seemed to be working fine. I didn't check her transmitter. And I told her, now, contact me when you leave. She said, okay, I'll contact you every 15 minutes after I leave. And he said, fine. So she did, and he heard her for about 200 miles until she faded out and couldn't hear her anymore. And so...
I wonder why they both would have been so reticent about saying they were having radio trouble.
Well, I think because Bendix put up some money, remember? Mm-hmm. And you don't tell sponsors that their equipment's still
damaged. I mean, good.
And she stopped, remember, in January of 36 at South Bend and saw Bendix and Vincent Bendix, and he put up $5,000, but no goodness of his heart, believe me. This is when Bendix Radio started their radio division, electronic division, and this Bendix RA1 receiver, a guy by the name of Taylor and Malcolm Taylor and
Moore.
And Vernon Moore, designed and built this thing. Luckily, Vernon Moore, bless his heart, kept a diary. And
imagine, he found his diary from 1936 and everything he had written
37.
Every day about working on this transmitter.
That's amazing.
And it was all, you know, if he hadn't had his diary, I wouldn't have believed him. And he had it all in there, all the correspondence, all the frequencies and everything. And Malcolm Taylor did all of the coils for it. And they both remember working on this one for Amelia Earhart. And then I have the picture of the fellow who died, Earl Remlin, bringing it out to him. Anyway, the point I was trying to make was that he did get the radio fixed, and it was working well when she left Darwin with it, and plus she had a spare fuse if it blew again. Well, we know it was working because she told the Itasca, I hear your signals, but I can't get a minimum. That took a little longer to figure out why she couldn't get a minimum. Now, what I'd like from you, if I've tingled you a little bit.
Oh, you have tingled me, no end.
Well, I'd like you to volunteer to come on along when we go out and look for her, okay? We look for the airplane. But I'd like some background about yourself as well. I got a lot of spare tapes. But I'd like you just, not wherever you want to start from, but I'd like you to tell about yourself and throw Amelia in wherever your paths cross, but I'd kind of like you to just talk about yourself for a while. Would you do that for me? I'll buy the beer if you'll do the talking.
Well, we'd like to know, how old you were when you started flying and where you started, and, you know, so we have some general background about your history. We know that you're very famous in aviation.
Right, so, but...
Well, I wrote a book in 1936, which tells quite a lot, and it was republished 2 or 3 years ago.
Is that available? Could we get a copy?
No, they unfortunately they sold out, and they apparently are not going to reprint it.
You have a copy of that.
But I'll loan you my copy.
Mm-hmm. We have a real good place at photocopy. We have a good photocopy of what we can return it to.
Well, I only have one copy left, and I'd be glad to loan it to you, which would save a tremendous amount of talking, because it does hit the high places.
Now, this is a reprint of the book in 1936,
mm-hmm.
and this would have been covered everything up till about that time?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Well, then we just need then just general information from you. Where did you first start to fly, and how did you get interested in it?
Well, that's in the book, too. All right. I can give you that, and I'll give you a copy of a personal and professional history, which gives the birth date and my mother
and
father.
I can copy that and return it to
you,
so you
won't. And all that kind of thing.
And I'll make copies of these things and return the originals to you so that you won't, you know, you won't be down anything.
Well, the personal and professional history you don't need to, but I do want the book back.
I understand that. In fact, I'm even hesitant to take it. If I wasn't so sure of the way I operate, I'd be
hesitant to give it to you if I didn't have implicit confidence.
All right. I've borrowed a lot of things, and sometimes I wonder why people loan them to me.
I can't get another one. Well, I mean, the time interval makes no difference as long as I get it back.
Yeah.
I don't want to beat on it too much, but I would like to get a couple of three things on the tape. One, you were one of the original 99s.
Yes.
And were you... Of course, being one of the original 99s, you must have been sort of instrumental in the thing getting together.
Well, yes, you think you could call me a founding and charter member of the 99. So, there were three or four of us who got to talking during the First National Women's Air Derby. And... decided
in 29.
Yeah. And that was really that derby was really the catalyst that got an organization started. And at that time, there were more women pilots on the East Coast, and particularly within about a 500-mile area of New York City, for instance, so that it gelled here in the East, because it was easier for us to get together. We were living in Pittsburgh at the time, and Amelia and Ruth Nichols and were in New York City, and so we got together a few times to organize, to get organized, and that's the way the 99s got started. And Amelia I was supposed to be president, because I guess I was the one who really sort of got it whanging. But I didn't think I should be, because Amelia had a name which everyone knew. And it was the only way you can hold an organization together, especially initially, if you're going to get the ball rolling and make it enticing for other women pilots to join. And so I just held out. And so we operated for a couple of years without a president. And I was secretary, doing all the work of really getting organized. And Blanche Noyes was the treasurer. And then finally, I prevailed on Amelia, and she did take over as president. I wish that I had a letter which I gave to Paige Schamburger. For about 3 years now, there's been trying to be organized, and I think it's going to gel now. at International Women's Air and Space Museum to collect and preserve memorabilia for as far back as we can go, primarily because of all the museums scattered around all over this country and all over the world. They do have a little about women in aviation, not necessarily pilots, I mean the whole gamut, but very little, and they could care less. So a tremendous amount of memorabilia has been irretrievably lost, like with Matilda Mossad and Harriet Quimby, who were among the first of the early women pilots, and Ruth Law and Catherine Stinson, who came on later. I mean, it's gone in the most part, and it's just a shame because women have, in their way and in various fields, made definite contributions to the advancement of aviation, and I think as time goes on, will the aerospace too. And all of that should be preserved. And if it could be in one place, that would be just fine, because the other museums don't want to fool with it. It's too small a part of the overall picture.
Is this what they're planning to do in Oklahoma City?
No, that's the 99 headquarters. And they are working on a museum type thing. But they have no space, really. And I think they should have a museum, but I think it should be confined to the history of the 99s and the people who have participated in it. Because they don't have the personnel, they don't have the money, and they don't have the space for a comprehensive museum. And this one, if it gels, will be in Dayton. And
I hope it does, yeah.
I hope it does, too, and I think it will, because the people around Dayton, the bankers and the businessmen, are very much in favor of it and behind it. The land has been secured, which is right off the Dayton airport, and then a highway juncture, a beautiful spot, and it isn't too far from the Air Force Museum. And it's a logical place.
Well, I hope so, because I have, you wouldn't believe, filing cabinets full of things about Amelia particularly.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in the process, I have tapes from people like yourself, all of which should be in the museum. What I'm putting down here today will eventually end up in a museum somewhere,
mm-hmm.
just talking together. I have hundreds of hours of tapes of interviews with people, as long as they will allow me to do it. And so some historian, 25, 50, 100 years from now,
yeah.
wants to hear what Louise had to say about this. At least this will be one small part of it.
Well, another thing, Paige Schamburger, who lives down at Aberdeen, North Carolina, was very active in the first 2 years of trying to get this International Air, Women's Air and Space Museum
she lives in
going.
I wish we had known that because we were interested in the CR2
well. Well, we'll be
made
back.
Tapes from various people for that very reason. And I made one on Amelia for. But she also has, and I wish I had it so you could see it, when Amelia took off from Teterboro and went up to Newfoundland for her first solo Atlantic try, Bert Balkin, you know, helped her on that one, and Eddie Gorski. And she was president of the 99s at the time, and I was still secretary. And Burke flew the airplane up so to save her energy. So she wrote me a letter in pencil on some old scrangy white paper about what all she thought should be done about the 99s in case anything happened to her. And there must be 5 or 6 pages of it. And on the back of the envelope, Burke scrawled, A.E. took off at whatever it was, and he mailed it from up there. And the page has quite a bit of stuff on Amelia that she's collected.
I met Burke before he died at an Explorers Club banquet. I was guest of honor.
They're wonderful guys.
Yeah, and I was sorry we didn't have more time to reminisce before he passed away.
Yeah, and a very droll person.
Norwegian.
Yeah.
Anyway, in regards to the memorabilia that I have, I would wish there would be some repository for it. I would hate to think that all the years and all the thousands of dollars I have spent, tens of thousands of dollars collecting all this stuff, that it would just
be lost.
I have over 1,000 pictures of, no, not that many. How many of them do I have?
Over
1,000 pictures of Amelia and various things to do with her. All cataloged and put away.
The International Women's Air and Space Museum would just love to.
I have some pictures, probably of you, but I have some pictures of a number, remember the roller skating picture and things like that where all the girls were on roller skates? I don't know what they were doing at the time, but I would like to make some good copies of these pictures, I mean Xerox of a good sort, and send them to you and ask if you could identify with the little arrows who these people are.
Okay.
And I'll enclose an envelope and everything and mail them back to me so I can identify. And then I'll put on the pictures who they are, or at least attach to the picture what they are, so that in the future, you know, after a while, you can't identify.
Yeah, I get just... people send me things like that all the time, you know, trying to identify who the people are. And sometimes I can, most of them, and sometimes I've forgotten who they were, too.
My company, Flying Tigers now, we have our first woman pilot.
Oh, do you?
Yes, she's in training right now, and she's going in just straight arrow, right as a pilot, no special
she
nothing.
She either hacks it or she doesn't.
Right, and she's just going to be a pilot. And I think they made an excellent choice of the young lady. They picked to break the ice, so to speak, because she has her head right on straight, right where it belongs, and willing to do all the work and take all the gaff that she's going to have to take, being first of everything. She's got to take all the little variations that go with it. And she's going to get
harder,
it. And she knows it, and she's willing to do it. And
well, Eastern has one.
That's right, and Frontier.
Frontier, and I think Allegheny Airlines has one now.
But, you know, here we are. How many years later now?
Well, and look.
45 years later, here where I say, and we got one here and one there. All right.
But the ice has been broken.
That's right. And when you started the 99s, you must have been getting a lot of this bad press, and or I shouldn't say bad press, they would call it chauvinistic press. And whatnot, and you know, it must have seemed so discouraging. You know, why do they have to be this way?
Well, it was discouraging and it was frustrating, and that was I think I brought it out in the book. Was one of the reasons why Amelia did all the things she did in flying. She had an absolute phobia about trying to break down the prejudice of the industry against women, and of course women pilots in particular, but also there were a bunch of women aeronautical engineers and draftsmen coming along at that time. They couldn't find jobs, and the once women palace found were very few and far between. If you were a woman, you couldn't be any good as a pilot. It was just a foregone conclusion, the part of everybody.
Yet you know yourself from your history as a pilot that you were perfectly capable of doing anything the men did.
Yes.
The Bendix Trophy race and all the things. What was your opinion of Amelia as a pilot? As a pilot, you know?
Well, Amelia really was just an average pilot. I have never said so out loud, and I wouldn't like you to say so either. But most people think that to do the things Amelia did, you have to be really a super pilot, sort of a Jimmy Doolittle or a Charles Lindbergh, who were absolutely as good, I guess, as you can ever get. But Amelia was average, and you have to take your hat off to her to have gone ahead and been able to accomplish the things she did, which took a superior type of ability, really, when she didn't actually, she wasn't that good.
She didn't have the natural instinct for flight.
No. And I know that I used to fly with her a fairish amount when she was flying to Vegas. And I always got the impression that she was just a little bit afraid of him. Well, that's good.
Yeah,
that's good. Be a little bit afraid and you live longer. But she was thoroughly capable. But you have a tendency to think that she was a lot better than she really was.
Well, she didn't really have that much time. In 32, she had 1,130 hours.
Yeah, well, she used to complain like everything when she went into the Vegas, that she flew and flew and didn't get any hours built up because the airplane was fast. And I remember she was so delighted. She talked Beechnut into flying around in that pit cairn for about a year, I guess she did it. And she said, "Oh, it's just wonderful." The time, you know, the time in the logbook was building up. Fast and furious. But you know, that I think that's another misconception. I don't think hours after you get a certain number mean too much. I've seen so many people who had 500 hours who were a lot better pilots than other people with 5,000, and you have too.
You know, I've instructed people who had 400 hours to fly large four-engine jet airplanes and had guys with 14,000 hours and had more trouble with a guy 14 than I did with them. It depends. As a point of interest, I don't want to sidetrack you because the kind of thing you're talking about is really beautiful for my purposes, trying to understand and to think like Amelia, and so I can tell it like she would be thinking it. The accident at Luke Field, I really haven't gone into it, and I wouldn't want to make a public statement, but I've uncovered considerable evidence in regards to that, and I don't think that was her fault either. What happened was,
no, I don't think it was.
She had a right-hand propeller froze up going into Honolulu. It froze where it was, and it was fixed pitch from that point on. So when they got to Honolulu, they had them overhaul that propeller. They took it off, and they had an awful time unfreezing it. They finally got it unfrozen, and they took it all apart and fixed the scoring and whatnot on it. Supposedly had it all fixed, put it all back together, and they didn't know what the high and low pitch stops were on it. She had a 20-degree gets changed.
Well, gee, you would have think Paul Mance would have known that.
Well,
he
wasn't there at the field, and it was in the middle of the morning, and they were about 3 o'clock in the morning. They'd worked all night putting this thing together. They thought she was going to leave that next morning at daylight, and they didn't call down to where they were staying at the Christian Holmes place. To wake him up in the middle of the night to ask him that, so they took a protractor on the other prop and measured from it what they thought the high and low pitch stop settings were and put it on. Well, they may have been right and they may not have, I don't know. Or, of course, the prop to start out would have been in low pitch, and then as she gathered speed it would have gone towards high pitch. Well, if it froze again, or if they didn't get the pitch stopped right, she wouldn't have got the RPM on the right engine she got on the left, and therefore it wouldn't have developed the same amount of power. And so then, therefore, the airplane, especially if it was lower, either because it stuck in too high a pitch or was set at the wrong high pitch stop, or low pitch stop, I'm sorry, the airplane wouldn't have developed much power on the right as on the left, and eventually, as the tail came up, the excess power on the left-hand side would have started a slow swerve to the right, and that's exactly what happened.
Well, it started it before the tail came up.
Well, she possibly with the tail down, she could have held it.
She had time. Well, I don't, not necessarily.
And then she started chopping the left throttle.
She had a big fat load, and also the runway, which at that time was blacktop. Was rutted, and it could have been a combination again.
But did you ever see her between that accident and?
Just two times.
When?
And she never did go into too much detail about the takeoff. I got the impression that she was afraid that maybe the airplane had gotten away from her. But unless something they found out about the prop or something later that would have made her change her mind, I don't know. That was the impression I had, that she felt like the airplane had gotten away from her. You know, Paul took it off. Paul flew it mostly over to Honolulu.
Yeah, she was saving herself.
Yeah. But. So she didn't have the experience with the load they took off from Oakland. And I don't know, that's another one of those things.
Well, actually, this Army report was rather self-serving, too. It was a confidential report, secret or confidential, I can't remember what, but it did all sorts of dancing, trying to not to come to any sort of a conclusion about what happened. I found it buried deep in the National Archives in an old Honolulu materiel file, and the most beautiful part of that whole thing was in that same file. After the airplane had cracked up, they had assigned a young lieutenant to be responsible for the airplane, and he set out to do an inventory, and he inventoried every pencil, everything in that airplane, serial numbers and everything.
Right?
So I have a complete record of everything that was in that airplane. And that was about it, including the cameras and the serial numbers on her cameras and everything else. So that was worth more than the rest of it put together. You did
well, of
see
course, a, did you find that they made some changes, both structurally and otherwise, when Lockheed rebuilt the airplane? They did a bunch of updating and I think they shifted the CG a little bit and added a few structural, beefed up here and there, and sort of updated the airplane for the job it was supposed to do.
Yeah, especially around the landing gear strut and the, yeah. And the tires, I think, with the little heavier rating tires.
So it was about, I think, I think they added about 300 pounds to the gross over what it had been as just a standard.
I have never come up with a weight and balance after the accident. I do have one before. Mm-hmm. I had the exact zero fuel weight and exact index. Kelly Johnson did some test flying, Amelia, on fuel consumption tests, and I was able to get off of them exactly what the weight and CGs were. But after the accident, I've never found anything that would...
wasn't exactly the same airplane as the one that...
They beefed it up and added a few hundred, a couple hundred pounds to it. You did see Amelia twice. Do you remember... either one of the incidences at all when you did see her in between the two?
Well, nothing just startling happened either time as far as conversations and things went. Amelia didn't talk too much about herself and or about what she was going to do. She... except in a kind of cursory sort of way. And she didn't like to, she went to all lengths so that the general public wouldn't know what she was going to do until she was ready to do it. And in all of her flights, she was that way. And I don't blame her. Amelia and GP, weren't getting along very well, and Amelia just didn't see eye to eye with GP on quite a few things, and she didn't like to be exploited as much as he was doing, and he was pushing her to go ahead and pick up the flight in the other direction, which she didn't want to do. She wanted to wait and go the way they had planned, wait for the next year. And he kept bringing up the fact that they were in hock as much as they were, because as much money as they had been able to raise, it still wasn't enough. And so they were counting on the book that Amelia was going to write, and which she was sending the excerpts back to GP on all through, plus lecture tours to, you know, pick up their end of the their indebtedness on it. And he was pushing her hard to go ahead and go around the other way. And Amelia was a very common sensey sort of person, and she kept her cool. She wasn't easily disturbed by things, and but GP really had her disturbed, and GP is, or was, a very overbearing person with a tremendous ego. And in a way, he dominated Amelia to a surprising degree. Amelia being the kind of person she was, but she also felt a great sense of loyalty to him, and an appreciation for everything he had done for her, which is why she married him in the first place, I think. It was through pressure and a sense of obligation. It wasn't the kind of love that you normally get married for. I mean, she admired him and liked him and all that kind of thing. And another factor, too, in her decision to marry him was that she felt that her position in the public eye was such that she shouldn't marry just a nobody, you know, somebody without any stature at all. And she talked to me one night, well, we talked all night almost, when she was trying to get her mind made up whether to, you know, what to do. And it was quite a decision, but which made it very difficult for her to buck GP in his insistence that she go ahead and complete the flight in the other direction. Amelia has always weighed every flight she's made with great meticulousness. She can look at the pros and the cons without bias or prejudice and weigh, and if the scales tip in the balance on the goal sign, then she'd go. If they tip the other way, she wouldn't go. And she felt that by going west to east at the time of the year it was, that it, the scales were balanced against her, and she didn't want to do it. And which is one reason I felt more badly than I normally would about what happened. But on the other hand, Amelia, like most of us in those days particularly were, she was a fatalist. And she figured that, like I always have, it's all written down in the little black book, and when it's your time to go, you go. And I remember before her first attempt, which is in the book, I was just finishing it when Amelia was lost and added a chapter. We were sitting on the rubber life raft out in front of Paul Mant's hangar, and I said to her, I just couldn't see the sense in making the round the world flight, because the navigational facilities were nothing in those days, and it was a hazardous flight. And particularly all the one from Honolulu to Howland, and then Howland to Lae. And although it wasn't much worse than some of that terrible country they flew over, but at least you weren't landing in the water.